Hi, thank you all for coming. Welcome. We're very grateful tonight to be joined by Peter Tatchell, a man whose life can be characterized maybe in large part by an unrelenting moral defiance. His activism has stretched continents and decades, and few people, certainly few public figures, have carried the weight and cost of principle so steadily. The 1983 Bermondsey by-election, where Peter Tatchell stood as a Labour candidate, is now regarded as one of the most overtly homophobic campaigns in modern British politics. It exposed the worst of our prejudice-weaponizing tabloid culture, the willingness of mainstream actors, not least Labour Party officials, to capitulate to that culture, and exposed the unsettling truth, maybe, that by-elections and referendums that revolve around bigotry are often more redeeming for the right than we might like to admit. The forces that conspired against Peter then, hysteria in the media, opportunistic centrism, and a right that's ready to mobilize resentment, are alive and well today, and Peter's experience gives him what I can only presume is a uniquely unsentimental understanding that when the left retreats, its trenches are taken over swiftly by the forces that it once held at bay. His commitment to non-negotiable human rights is something which is very welcome in this room, especially because of the topic today about the consequences of the left losing its footing. So I'll hand over to Peter Tatchell, then there'll be some questions from Enioma and myself before we open up to the floor. So please do get thinking and join me in a warm round of applause for Peter Tatchell.
Thank you very, very much. The title of tonight's talk is What's Wrong with the Left and How to Fix It? So I am coming at this question as a left-winger who is somewhat dismayed by the failure of the left to make traction. Right now, the left in this country is on the back foot. It has failed to develop a set of ideas and strategies to make left-wing policies appealing and vote-winning. So the starting point, of course, is where we are now in British politics. For the last year, over the course of more than 100 different opinion polls, Reform UK is in the lead. A shocking indictment of the left and its failures that a far-right party is now consistently in the lead and would win a general election if it was held tomorrow. But this isn't a flash in the pan. It's been this way for nearly a year. On current polling, both Labour and the Tories are somewhere between 15 and 20%, well below Reform's polling of 30 to 34%. There is no doubt that unless things change radically, Nigel Farage will be the next British Prime Minister. A terrifying thought, given his and his party's policies. But where is the left-wing strategy, the policies, the ideas to counter that? Oh yes, the left shouts racist, fascist, far-right extremist. That doesn't cut it. That's not a strategy. We have to think, analyze, and come up with counter-ideas that can undermine reform. The only people making a serious effort to counteract the impact of reform are Zach Polanski and the Greens. Whether you agree with them or not, they are cutting through where everybody else has failed. In the recent polls, and going back some months now, The Greens are either level pegging with Labour or ahead of Labour. In the opinion polls, the Greens are the main opposition to Reform UK. Isn't that an indictment of the traditional left? That they are so hopeless, so inadequate, that it's the Greens now who are cutting through and making the headway. The Greens are also the only major national party with a strategy to defeat Reform. Again, an appalling indictment of other left forces in this country. Some Reform supporters are racist. That is true. But not all of them. Indeed, many of them are not. Many Reform supporters are just frustrated and angry that their concerns have been persistently ignored by the two main parties, Labour and the Tories. And it's not just about immigration and small boats. It's about the cost of living crisis. It's about affordable housing. It's about not being able to get a GP's appointment. It's about parts of the country where there are no NHS dentists. Ordinary people in this country have been let down for decades by the two main parties, and that includes Labour. Labour, who's supposed to stand up for working people and for social justice and fairness. So that anger is being deflected into scapegoating migrants and refugees. A wholly idiotic scapegoating, because clearly migrants and refugees account for a tiny, tiny proportion of the cost of this country. The real problem in terms of inadequate schools and hospitals and so on is not because of migrants or refugees. It's because there are some people in this country who have fabulous wealth. Over 150 billionaires in this country, many of whom pay derisory levels of tax through various tax avoidance schemes, which neither Labour nor the Tories have ever closed. We see all across the country large swathes of communities and peoples who feel left behind, ignored, and neglected. And they're angry, and they're right to be angry, but not to scapegoat migrants and refugees. We need to put an alternative, a clear alternative. And that clear alternative needs to address the reason why many Reform voters are giving the two fingers to the two main parties. Reform is exploiting absolutely legitimate grievances about the cost of living, the lack of affordable housing, and so on. Those are real, genuine grievances that successive governments have ignored, not for years, but for decades. While giving tax breaks to the super rich, while not having a fair taxation system that puts greater onus on those with greater wealth to pay more. As Spider-Man might have said, with great wealth comes great responsibility. But the two main parties don't see it that way. Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer have met business people many times more than they've ever met trade union representatives or representatives from civil society organizations. They go out of their way to court big business while ignoring their core supporters and the organizations that represent their interests. So that's the core of the problem. If Labour hits working people with more tax, which it has been threatening to do, if it doesn't tax the billionaires, the banks, the gambling industry, the big energy companies, it will drive more voters to Reform. Because people will be rightly angry. We are the sixth wealthiest country in the world. The 50 richest families in Britain have more wealth than the poorest 50% of the population. That cannot be right. That cannot be right. So the Green Party and some of the other small left-wing parties recognize this. That's why they're focusing relentlessly on the cost of living crisis. Policies to help the left behind, people who see their high streets boarded up, who can't get an NHS dentist appointment, who are pulling out their teeth with their pliers because they can't afford to go private. That's a damning indictment, a shameful indictment of Labour and the Conservatives. The Greens are saying we have to make tackling the cost of living crisis the number one priority to raise living standards, to lower the cost of living, to reduce poverty. If we can tackle those grievances, some people attracted by reform will perhaps be won back away from reform. So this whole issue of tackling the legitimate grievances of millions of people about the cost of living, affordable housing, and so on, that's one aspect of the strategy against reform, to undercut those grievances that reform exploits. The other is the Green strategy of voting reform, based on the democratic principle that the percentage of seats won by a party should correspond to the percentage of votes won by that party. And of course, this policy is also endorsed by the SNP, by Plaid Cymru, by the Liberal Democrats and others. You know, it cannot be right that we have such a skewed, corrupt voting system that since 1931, no party has ever won a majority of the public vote. Every single government we have had, including Margaret Thatcher's landslide in 1983, Tony Blair's landslide in 1997, it was all won on a minority of votes, around 42 or 43% of the vote. That's not democracy. Democracy is supposed to be when people elect a representative parliament, a parliament that reflects the broad wishes of the people. So, if you look at the 2024 general election, Labour won the support of only 20% of eligible voters, only 34% of those who actually voted, but won 63% of the seats and 100% of the power. That is not democratic. It's not what the Chartists and the suffragettes fought for. We cannot go on with a corrupt voting system that allows time and time again, minority parties with minority support to form governments. Reform is currently polling 30 to 34% of the vote. That's enough for Reform to win a majority of over 400 seats and form a government, based on only a third of the vote. They would have an outright majority and Nigel Farage would be Prime Minister. That's because our first-past-the-post system is not fit for purpose. It was a perfect system when there were only two parties, but we now live in a seven-party democratic system. Seven parties on a first-past-the-post system. It does not work. We are one of the only democracies in the world that has first past the post. All the progressive governments around the world have a form of proportional representation. Now, that same poll that suggests that Labour would, that Reform would win in excess of 400 seats on current polling, that same poll suggests that Labour would end up with 70 to 100 seats. 70 to 100. The Tories with about 50 seats, and the Lib Dems and the Greens with about 70 to 80. So I'm saying to you, the only sure way to stop reform is by changing the voting system. Because if reform wins 30 to 34% of the vote under a PR system that would only have 30 to 34% of the seats, not enough to form a government. So reforming the voting system to abolish first past the post and replace it with a system of PR is absolutely crucial to the fight to defeat reform. We already have a proportional voting system in Northern Ireland, in Scotland, in Wales, and in the London Assembly. It's a combination of constituency MPs with top-ups to ensure proportionality in terms of members elected from each party. It works. If it works in all these other elections, why can't we have it for Westminster as well? Now, of course, people will say, how are we going to get there? Well, the first big problem is the vast majority of Labour members support a switch to proportional representation. It was even voted through at a Labour conference. But Keir Starmer is refusing to implement it. He's putting his own ego and party self-interest before the democratic principle that we should have a representative parliament. Now, this is not democracy. And by taking this stance, opposing PR, Keir Starmer is paving the way for Nigel Farage to be PM. And if he does become PM, Keir Starmer will have that albatross hung around his neck for history. He was the man who refused to allow the Labour members, as they agreed, to secure a change in voting system, to stop reform. Now, I speak with some considerable personal pain. I have known Keir Starmer for 40 years. In my 20s and 30s, we knew each other. We campaigned on socialist, feminist, ecological, LGBT plus rights policies. He was a really good guy. I don't know what's happened to him since, but now he is a completely different person. And that, for me, is a personal tragedy as well as a political one. He has been hijacked, imprisoned by the Blairites who surround him at Labour HQ. He's not true to the man I once knew. So, if Nigel Farage is set to become PM, you would think that a Labour government would try and do something to stop him, both in terms of changing policies to tackle the cost of living crisis and to change the voting system. But I'm not saying this for opportunistic reasons. I've been supporting proportional representation for almost 50 years. And I've criticised Labour governments when they won a majority of seats based on a minority of votes. So this is not me adopting a policy out of advantage for my particular politics. This is a core democratic principle. So one of the other biggest failings of the left is not mounting a major campaign for proportional representation. No, where are the protests, the marches, the lobbies of parliament? Where is the alliance between left-wing progressives with the SNP, Plaid Cymru, the Lib Dems? There's none. Everybody is just sitting back like rabbits staring into the headlights. And the result will be Prime Minister Nigel Farage. I sometimes wonder, does the left actually believe in democracy? I know sections of the right do not, but you would have thought the left would believe in democracy and would fight for it. But I don't see any indication that they are or will. Some people say, well, look, you know, if you have PR, you end up with coalitions. So what? So what? Every other left-wing government and social movement around the world accepts that if you can't win a majority of votes, you have to go into coalitions. And I would say this, any coalition is better than a reform government. And why can't the left see this? The left wants 100% of the power for itself. That's the problem. That's not democratic, and it paves the way for Nigel Farage. It's a profoundly authoritarian mindset. Profoundly authoritarian. If you're not willing to accept, if you can't win a majority of votes, you have to work with others. A lot of people used to condemn Arthur Scargill, the leader of the National Union Mine Workers, who led the great mine workers' strike in the 1980s. But he was absolutely clear. If socialists cannot win a majority support, they must go into coalition with other parties. There must be PR. You cannot accept a system where you have socialism hijacked and imposed by a bureaucratic, corrupt voting system. A basic fundamental principle is, for the left, is unite the many to defeat the few. There was the Popular Front in France against fascism in the 1930s and 40s. Here we had in Britain the rise of the Commonwealth Party during the Second World War, the most radical party in British history, which united people from Labour, the Lib Dems, Independents, Christian Socialists, trade unionists, and they won a slew of by-elections during the wartime, based on the principle of unite the many to defeat the few. Sink our differences to fight and win the greater cause. So I would say, now, there is an urgent need for collaboration between Labour, the Greens, the Lib Dems, Plaid, the SNP, the SDLP in Northern Ireland, perhaps even Sinn Féin. The number one priority is to stop Nigel Farage and reform. And it's the simple principle. There can be no democracy without a fair voting system. And we don't have a fair voting system right now. It's the only way, with certainty, to stop reform. Reform will never win a majority of popular support in this country. It will never. But it risks coming to power based on minority support because of our corrupt voting system. Now we have the rise of your party, Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana, a new player on the left in British politics. And hand on heart, I wish them well. I thought, you know, your party and the Greens together, they can work together, they can make a change. But look at the infighting, the sectarianism, the disputes over money, the resignations. It's complete shambles. It's chaotic. The British people will never trust your party because of the way it's behaved. I wish it hadn't been like this. You know, more left forces, as far as I'm concerned, the better. But they have completely shot themselves in the foot, and their credibility is gone. On top of that, within your party, it has attracted a hodgepodge collection of very diametrically opposed people. They all want change. They all want, you know, some form of socialism or social justice. They're fed up with the two big parties. They want radical policies to defend and support working people. Great. But they include old-style communist Stalinists, unreconstructed Trotskyists, as well as anarchists and, to be fair, democratic socialists, radical democratic socialists, who believe in democracy and believe in the principle of universal human rights. A lot of people supporting your party do not believe in universal human rights. They're very selective about which rights they want to believe. Their view is the West is bad, anybody who opposes the West is good. So they're soft on Russia, soft on Iran, soft on China. Wherever there's a dictatorship that takes on the West, they will either support the dictatorship or remain silent about it. The British people are not going to buy that. They see through hypocrisy and double standards. They can see that these particular swarms of left-wingers, they preach human rights when it comes to Britain, but they will accept violations of human rights in other countries because they're opposed to the West. A very perverse, and some might say racist, attitude towards non-white people and those who are not in the West. I'm not saying all your people are, all your party people are like that. They're not all like that. But there is a sizable minority within who are, and I've heard them from their own mouths. The question we have to ask is, why do we need your party? It's basically got the same policies as the Green Party. Your party people say, oh, the Greens are just environmentalists. No, they're not. They support all the same policies, the public ownership of utilities, a fairer taxation system, including a wealth tax on the very, very rich. What's the difference? There's no real difference between your party and the Greens. So why have two competing rival left of centre parties who are going to split the left votes and aid Labour and Reform? That doesn't make sense. Moreover, as of the moment, the Green Party has, what, four MPs, over 800 councillors, elected members in the Scottish Parliament and the London Assembly. Your party has no one elected on a Your Party ticket. It's an unknown. So if there's going to be collaboration between your party and the Greens, then I think your party needs to show a bit of humility and acknowledge the gains that the Greens have already achieved with radical left-wing policies. And sure, if it comes to an election, I hope they will agree to stand down in favour of each other in selected seats so they don't split the left vote. But the voice I'm hearing from many people in your party is, no, 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 we are the only true party. The Greens are rubbish. You know, they're just environmentalists, middle class, white. You look at the Green Party today, it's far from any of that. So I don't see much willingness to be cooperative from some people in the Green, in your party. There are some who are open to collaboration alliances. That's good. That's great. But many are not. So if we want to change things, we have to work out some kind of deal between your party if it comes into existence. It's supposed to come into existence, I think, this coming weekend. And just to make sure that the progressive left vote is not split. But there are other issues where the left has seriously failed. And one of them is economic democracy. Even Jeremy Corbyn in his best days was advocating public ownership of the utilities, investment in public services, improved wages and conditions. Great. But none of those policies were about the structural reform of capitalism. They were all reforms within the existing capitalist framework. I would like to think that we could go beyond that. Right now, in terms of our economy, Britain is an economic dictatorship. We are an economic tyranny where the rich and powerful hold all the votes. So in the voting system, we expect one person, one vote. But in the economy, the major shareholders, investors, managers and directors, they have all the votes, and employees and consumers have none. That's what you call a dictatorship. Surely, we would hope and want for a democratic alignment between the political system and the economic system. But I don't see anyone on the left, apart from me and a handful of others, advocating for forms of economic democracy. For those who've read your history, in the 1970s, the quite right-wing Labour government of James Callaghan commissioned Lord Bullock to write a report on ideas for economic democracy. He proposed that every enterprise with more than 50 employees should by law require to appoint through democratic election by workers 50% employee representation on the management boards of all companies. And people like me argued that should be extended to public bodies like the National Health Service and local councils. 50% representation. Can you imagine how that would change the balance of power between capital and labor? How it would have given working people real meaningful say in the way the enterprises were run? A huge advance for power for ordinary people. But the left and the trade unions voted it down, saying it was corporatism. It was sucking workers into the capitalist system. No, it wasn't. It was giving them a right to have a quasi-veto over what management did. It would have given ordinary working people immense power, immense influence, access to corporate information, the right to make decisions about new technology, wages, conditions, health and safety, environmental policies, and so on. Well, I think we need to get back to those ideas. And at the very least, what I propose, currently proposing, is that every public and private enterprise with more than 50 employees should be required to have one-third employee elected representatives and one-third consumer representatives on the board, so that both employees and consumers are represented. And this would apply not just to private companies, but also to the National Health Service, local councils, and other public bodies. No one, apart from a handful of us on the left, are proposing this. They're obsessed with wages, public ownership of utilities, but not about power and control. The left, I just tear my hair out. Nationalization is not the answer. Ownership is not the issue. Control is the issue. After the Second World War, when the Labour government nationalized public utilities, they operated in the same way as private businesses. The people at the top had all the power. The workers, the employees had no power whatsoever. They were state capitalist institutions run on capitalist lines, disenfranchising the people who worked in them. Yet that's the model that most of the left endorse today, state ownership. Well, I'm all in favor of public utilities being under public ownership. But I also want to see working people and consumers to have power and control as well. So that's one issue. A second issue is Ukraine. There is a section of the left which defends, very rightly, self-determination for Palestine, but not self-determination for Ukraine. They want to stop Western military aid to Ukraine. And as we all know, that would mean Russian conquest. It would mean a Russian fascist state, an imperialist aggressor, would seize control of Ukraine. What kind of left-winger can support that? Well, sadly, there are quite a lot. Stop the War Coalition. Their battle cry is cut the aid to Ukraine. No more military aid. Ukraine must surrender, must give territory to Russia. They didn't say that to the people of Vietnam when they were fighting the United States imperialism. They didn't say that to any other country fighting for freedom and self-determination. But apparently, because Ukraine is backed by the West, Ukraine are the baddies. And there's a section of the left that repeat all the Russian talking points. They say Ukraine must be conquered because Russia is doing the right thing to denazify Ukraine. Well, there are Nazis in Ukraine, a very tiny, small number. There isn't a single Nazi MP in the parliament. There's no Nazis in the Ukrainian government. But in Russia, Nazis have open collaboration with the government. And I've been a victim. At the behest of state security, I was beaten up, almost beaten unconscious, in Russia a decade ago by neo-Nazis acting in cahoots with Russian state security. The apologists also say, this is not about Ukraine, it's NATO's war. No, it's not. Ukraine is fighting for its right to self-determination. It's a war of self-defense, like Britain waged against the Nazis during the Second World War. That argument, that this is just a NATO war, infantilizes Ukrainian people. It says, we in the West and left, we know better. You're just pawns for NATO. You should just give up and cede your territory to Putin. Stop the War Coalition wants a peace agreement that would cede Crimea, the Donbass, and the other regions of Ukraine to Putin. That's the kind of settlement they want. As I said, in battles against Western imperialism in the past, they've never said that oppressed nations should give up their territory to the oppressor and aggressor. It is complete double standards. And you know, no left that holds those kind of opinions will ever win the support of the British people. We lived through the Blitz. We lived through the fascist onslaught during World War II. We know that people have a right to self-defense. And Ukraine should get every bit of Western military weapon it needs to defend itself. But more importantly, and here's another great failure, if you don't agree with war, and I don't really want war, I don't like war, but I propose an alternative. Yes, we can give Ukraine the weapons it needs, but really what would help Ukraine the most is to wage economic war on Russia. So no one on the left is saying, seize the secret oil and gas tanker fleet that Russia is using to export its oil and gas around the world to fund the war. Seize the fleet is an obvious thing, to defund the war. Kick Russia out of the global financial system so it can make no trades through the global financial system. Impose 200% tariffs on any country that trades with Russia. Those three policies would cause Russia's economic collapse within 6 to 12 months without having to fire a single shot. Yet no one on the left is arguing for this non-violent strategy. They say they oppose war, but they won't even support a non-violent strategy. Another issue, Palestine. I've been on every single march. Well, I've been supporting Palestine for 54 years. Been on every single march since the 7th of October, bar two, because I was away. a lot of the people in that march demand one state, the erasure of Israel. They're entitled to that opinion, but it isn't what the Palestinians want. The representatives of Palestine argue for two states, Israel and Palestine coexisting. So what gives this section of the left in the West the right to override the wishes of the Palestinian people and impose its preferred solution? This is a form of Western leftism that mirrors neocolonialism. Again, it denies the Palestinian people their own agency to decide their own future. Let's just hear some of the things they say. Hamas is a resistance movement and should be supported. Some resistance movement. The 7th of October caused the biggest disaster for the people of Palestine since the Nakba in the 1940s. What a militarily misguided decision to launch that attack on the 7th of October. Anybody with any brains would know that that would produce a massive Israeli retaliation. As a result of what Hamas has done, nearly 70,000 Gazans are dead. The whole country has been reduced to a rubble like it had been hit by an atomic bomb. The majority of people killed have been women and children, including at least 20,000 children. Now, Israel did that, and I condemn that genocide absolutely. But it wouldn't have done it if Hamas had not been so stupid to launch that attack on the 7th of October. And I'm all in favor of Palestinian resistance, but not the killing of innocent civilians. Let's not forget that among the people massacred on the 7th of October were Bedouin Palestinian Arabs, massacred in their homes and tents, were Israeli Jews who've been championing the rights of Palestine, who've been sending aid to Gaza, who were supporting the right of Palestinian people to have their own homeland. They were massacred by Hamas. Hamas are absolute monsters. They are a theocratic fascist regime that dictates by religion how people in Gaza live. The leftists say, oh, but Hamas won the election. Hamas has majority support. No, it didn't. The last election was held. Hamas won 44% of the vote. Not a majority. Then it seized power in Gaza and massacred supporters of rival political parties like Fatah. It's maintained power ever since by a police state. There is no free press in Gaza, no right to form trade unions, no right to protest, no human right of any kind exists in Gaza. It's been that way ever since Hamas seized power. They are a dictatorship. How can anybody on the left support a regime that's a dictatorship? A regime that treats women as second and third class citizens, that jails and tortures and sometimes kills LGBTs, that arrests and tortures and jails people who try to form trade unions, that kills journalists who write critical things about them. The left would not support any of that in this country, but they think it's okay in Gaza. It's not. It's not right anywhere. So, you know, if you're going to have credibility, you've got to be consistent. If you stand for human rights in this country, you should stand for human rights in all countries. And when it comes to Hamas, they are the baddies, pure and simple. They have been oppressing Palestinian people ever since they seized power. And the most recent polls show that only 6 to 12% of Gazans support Hamas. Only 6 to 12%. Because they've seen the suffering that Hamas has inflicted on them, not just as a result of Israel's retaliation after the 7th of October, but also the tyrannical regime that Hamas has imposed upon the people of Gaza ever since it seized power. They don't want Hamas. Hamas won't allow free and fair elections because it knows it would lose. So, you know, going forward, the people of both Gaza and the West Bank deserve free and fair elections, just as we expect in this country. And, you know, the most esteemed Palestinian leader, Marwan Barghouti, who's been jailed and tortured by Israel for 23 years now, he's the most esteemed Palestinian leader. He would win any vote for president if it was held. He has said, absolutely, we must stand for coexistence, peaceful coexistence between Israel and Palestine. There must be a two-state solution with democracy, human rights, and justice for all the people in both Israel and Palestine. That's his view, and he represents the majority of the Palestinian leadership. But some on the Western left think, oh no, we know better. No, no, no. One state, Hamas can be part of it. No, no, no. The arrogance of some people on the left is breathtaking. They have a neo-colonial mindset. They want to dictate to people struggling for their freedom about how to fight and what to fight for. Another example, Iran. There's a whole section of the left that, because the West has threatened Iran, either supports Iran or at least is silent about human rights abuses in Iran. So I'll give you an example. At one of the Stop the War Coalition's big rallies in Hyde Park about 20 years ago, they had a speaker on the platform speaking in support of and in defense of the Iranian regime. In that crowd were Iranian Democrats and leftists. They were violently attacked by Stop the War stewards to silence them and to force them out of the protest. But they gave a platform to the representative of a dictatorship in Tehran. We all know the crimes of the Iranian regime, the conquest and seizure of Arabistan, the mass oppression of Arabs within Iran, the mass oppression of Kurds in Iran, the mass oppression of Baluch in Iran. We know the way they treat women. The Women Life Freedom protests were against that, to say, no, we should not be forced to wear the hijab against our will. We know the mass arrest of trade unionists, the torture and abuse of trade unionists in Iran, the bus workers. In one single night some years ago, 800 bus worker union members were arrested and jailed and abused by the regime. Was there any left-wing organization in Britain or any trade union in Britain who spoke out against that? No. As far as I know, not one. Not one. Fellow trade unionists arrested, jailed and tortured. And the British left and trade unions, as far as I know, said nothing. Another occasion, there was a big rally in Trafalgar Square, and Stop the War Coalition had a representative of Muqtada al-Sadr from Iraq on the platform. This was a representative of a religious political movement, an Islamist movement, that has among its objectives the total suppression of women, LGBTs, trade unionists, and ethnic and religious minorities. They gave him a platform to promote his fascist theocratic regime or fascist theocratic movement. And again, those of us who raised protests were described as racists and Islamophobes. No, we weren't. We weren't attacking anybody's race or religion. We were attacking the fact that Stop the War Coalition was giving a platform to someone who presided over terror groups that were going out and executing critics and opponents, anybody who spoke out against them. I know, because around that time, I was contacted by an Iraqi doctor. He was being hunted by Muqtada al-Sadr because it was suspected he was gay. They threw hand grenades into his house in the middle of the night. Fortunately, he was working at hospital. Then they came to the hospital to find him and kill him. Amazingly and courageously, many of the women nurses took him in to their own private quarters and hid him there. And eventually I helped with others to escape, get him escaped and get him to Britain. But he was being hunted by this organization led by Muqtada al-Sadr. The final example I'll give you is Syria. Sections of the left backed Bashar al-Assad, the dictator president of Syria, despite his mass killing of civilians. Remember the Syrian uprising against the dictatorship? Mass peace of protests. Assad responded by shooting and gunning people down. Most of the left was either supportive of Assad, saying he was a bulwark against US imperialism, as if that justified killing civilians, or they refused to support the democratic opposition. And those of us who support the democratic opposition were told we were supporting jihadists, terrorists. One of the untold stories of the Syrian revolution is, in the wake of that uprising, all across the country, there were networks of democratic grassroots organizations established to provide basic services to people where the state had collapsed, but also to resist and oppose the Assad regime. They got no help from the Western left. I thought the Western left was all about solidarity with people struggling for freedom. No, no, not if you're in Syria. On top of that, when Putin and Assad bombed the Palestinian refugee camp, Yarmouk, not a squeak of criticism or protest by the Western left. The Western left, who championed the cause of Palestine when Palestinians were killed en masse by the indiscriminate bombing of a Palestinian refugee camp by Putin and Assad, said nothing. Again, monstrous hypocrisy and double standards. You know, when Aleppo and other cities were under siege from Assad and Putin, the mass indiscriminate bombing of those cities, acting on the requests of Syrians in those cities, I and others petitioned the British government and Jeremy Corbyn to support, at the very least, the airdropping of food, medicine, and fuel to those besieged cities. We got absolutely no support. I've got a lot of time for Jeremy Corbyn. He's often misrepresented, but he refused to bring a motion to Parliament to support the airdropping of civilian aid to civilians in Aleppo during Assad and Putin's mass bombing. That was a terrible, terrible, terrible failing by Jeremy Corbyn. I'll just finish by saying that these criticisms are not of all the left. I'm not saying all the radical left are like this, but there are a sizable minority, perhaps even in some cases a majority, who do have a really, really big problem about moral and ethical consistency, about political consistency. As I said, if you're going to stand for human rights, you have to stand for human rights in this country and every country. And just because someone is opposing US or Western imperialism doesn't mean they get a free ride to abuse human rights. So to round up, I mean, I think if the left is going to have credibility, it's got to fix these problems. Because the British people are not going to vote for left-wingers who prevaricate and obfuscate and engage in double standards. When it comes to, I'll just finish on Ukraine, the Greens, which are basically inclined towards pacifism and nonviolence, nevertheless recognize that military aid for Ukraine is essential for that country's survival. But they are under attack from people in your party and other radical left groups. Those groups, those people, are basically doing Putin's propaganda work for him. They're aiding the Putin propaganda machine and indeed Putin's political and military aims. So if we want to win, we have to fix this. And this talk tonight is all about fixing it. I'm not here to denounce the left, but I'm making some valid criticisms in a constructive spirit to put things right so the left can win, so we can defeat reform, so we can enact radical social change to benefit the people of this country. It's a very simple ask, and I hope that all of us can step up to it. Thank you.